The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Caroline Stokes. Caroline is a human capital entrepreneur, helping everyone move forward in the fourth industrial revolution. She founded Forward, an executive headhunting and executive coaching company designed for global innovation leaders, and she hosts the Emotionally Intelligent Recruiter podcast and learning platform to help recruiters evolve in the AI age. She has a new book. It's called Elephants Before Unicorns, Emotionally Intelligent HR Strategies to Save Your Company. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
One of our recent guests on the podcast was Richard Boyatzis, who is a frequent collaborator of Daniel Goleman, who popularized the concept of emotional intelligence in his book of the same name. And you write in the introduction of your book, quote, "When I read Goleman's book, it was like a bomb hitting me. That was it. This was the tool I'd been looking for. How much more successful would companies be with emotionally intelligent leaders at the helm?" So let's start there. Talk to us a bit about what emotional intelligence is and how do you see its translation into the workplace?
Yes, Daniel Goleman really did completely change my brain. It was something that at the time impacted my ability to be able to understand what was going on. So back in the olden days, back in the 80s, 90s, and even obviously beforehand, before Daniel Goleman was able to identify what the issues were and to be able to identify how people could change, we were all running robotically. We were all living in the ideal, or at that time, that you just showed up at work, you punched in, you punched out, and that's how it was. You had to separate your life. Since Daniel Goleman and many other emotional intelligence leaders came to the fore and wrote books, and there are so many out there, once they were able to say, actually, it is emotions that help power every single interaction that you have right now, every decision that you make, and then being able to identify the different emotions that are built or created in our brain that then create that outcome from a conversation that you're having, an argument that you're having, a belief that you have. When you understand your emotional and your social operating system, because we're all unique, there is no cookie cutter guide on everyone having their own style, you're then able to understand how you operate with your families and, of course, in your work, so you are able to then be more successful.
And this has never been more important because we are now living in this digitized world. We're living in the world of AI. We're looking at what the future of work says. And when you look at the future of work, so much of these mundane tasks are going to be done by robots, that our humanness is going to be our advantage in the future, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The most important and crucial thing that people forget is that we all spend lots of time on the computer, or we spend time on our cell phone, and we're craving that kind of human interaction. We're wanting to do it, whether it's by email, text message, on WhatsApp, whatever technology people prefer. And what happens is that we are forgetting the human aspects that are just so important, and the motivations and the reflexes that we have. And soon, we're all looking forward in some way to the way that AI, and you call it robots, are going to be able to take over so many functions, chatbots, etc. You're able to have a conversation on a chatbot, for example, and you don't have to deal with somebody that might be a little bit dreary or may not necessarily understand what you're talking about because the systems behind it are just going to become so finely tuned. But at the same time, that will tick that box. It will reduce our frustration. But then we have to then focus on what kind of meaningful relationships can we have so we can solve the really big challenges that face us.
And I guess we should also do another definition. You talk about unicorns and elephants. Give us the context for that.
So the reason for coming up with the book title, Elephants Before Unicorns, I was sitting with a friend from World Bank, and I was telling her about the elephants before unicorns, and she said, yes, you're right. There are these elephants in the room that organizations don't think about, and they don't talk about, and they just become so big that they then start bringing the company down. So when somebody like my friend understood exactly what I was talking about, that was then preventing an organization from attracting the people that are really going to impact the organization's growth in the AI age, the title made so much sense. So elephant being the issue, the unicorn being the type of talent you either want to hire or retain or evolve.
Yeah, I love it. It's a very clean metaphor. And so much of this book, it's very practical, but I also enjoy the fact that it is, you know, you've got both stories and then you have evidence that we're talking about. All right, hiring. Chapter 3 is titled, Your Hiring Process is Too Fast. Talk to us about that.
Everybody wants to hire somebody right now. The North American system, including Canada, which is where I live, is really broken because somebody can hand in their notice and 2 weeks later they're gone. And if you're trying to find somebody that is as competent, as maybe innovative, as driven as that person that you've just lost, it could take 6 months. And what happens in that time? You're then putting so much pressure on the people that are within the organization to be able to take that load. And so much strategic time and stress is passed on to all of these different people. So the reality is the hiring process is too fast because what happens is people rush into finding that unicorn or that person that is going to really take that person forward. What I advise in the book is for people to stop and think and have conversations about what they really need, where the company is going, and how the person or how the organization or how the role or how the department or how the product needs to evolve so they're able to find somebody that is going to be even better than the person that they have lost and they're obviously grieving and mourning their loss of. So it's a huge hodgepodge of emotions at that time, and people will rush and put pressure on recruiters to hire that person in a breakneck speed. And during that time, the recruiters will unfortunately be so rushed that they will be presenting people that may not be the right fit. Or they'll be in a situation, they'll be rejecting people because maybe they don't understand the brief well enough. So there are lots of opportunities for that whole cycle and system to break.
Yeah, and the social science is very clear on this, which is that we think we have a much better handle on the ability to read people or to understand their capabilities than is anywhere close to being true. And then the evidence, at least that I've seen, is if you want to get to the truth, you have to ask a lot of questions. And you wrote in the book, quote, remember, the more communication, the better. The only way you're going to get to know these people is by talking to them over and over again. And by the way, it probably shouldn't be just in that one sitting. It's the follow-up too, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is in the follow-up because what happens is people change. Once you are in a glorious situation where you have a conversation, in the book I outline how to have your very first conversation with somebody to really identify your new hire or somebody that's been with you for many years, what their goals are, what they feel that they do best, how they can best communicate with you, and so on. And things change in that process. If you just leave it there, it's almost like just leaving a project on hold, mm-hmm. parking something for a long time and allowing it to just collect dust. You have to evolve it. You have to create that trust. You have to follow through and really keep to the beat of those individuals to understand where they're are at any time.
You know, it's interesting, and this has come up a few times with different guests on the podcast. The business world would be very wise, if the business world is looking for getting the best performance out of their people, they would be very wise to look at the arts and sports and these other places where they're also grooming best performers. And what normally happens in those situations is you have, you know, minor leagues and you have touring companies and you, and, you know, before you get to Broadway, you're doing all this other kind of practice and work in an ecosystem. It's somehow in business, it feels like we're just going to find these like magic people who are just going to show up on our doorstep when people evolve. And also you have to figure out what they're good at and make sure you're placing them in a place where they're going to be able to do their best work.
Absolutely. And you also have to consider exactly how much they are going to be interested in that particular company.
Yeah.
So suppose you just talked about your C-League, and a C-League thinks, understandably, that they're an A-League type of organization. And an A or a B or a C-League candidate may go, no, I don't see it like that. So there can be a real mismatch of somebody's own self-perception. And that's where, if you look at the emotional intelligence EQI 2.0, if you've got a CEO or a team that has a really high self-regard, but really not very high, reality testing, then you're going to have this disconnect. And that can really help fail a company.
Yeah, and so you talk about the sort of understanding of self, but also the brands need to understand their story and their self, because people don't want to work for certain kinds of brands because they're not compelling.
Mm-hmm. Because everybody has their own brand preferences. And ever since I worked in marketing in the 90s, I knew at the time there was a real connection with regards to the way that marketing market the brands through to the employer brand. And if they're not connected, then there's a disconnect and people aren't going to feel like they're doing what they should be doing, because it may be all glitz and glamour on the outside, and then inside no one is being innovative or nobody is really driving things through, because it's a culture based on fear or hierarchy or whatever the situation is. So the brand aspect is hugely important and they need to connect.
You tell the story of Graham Johnson, who was the former global head of employer brand and talent acquisition strategy at British Telecommunications. And I thought this was very interesting because, you know, he went in and realized that these folks needed to know and tell a compelling story, and they weren't doing it. And he actually invested resource in creating films, right? The art that could help reimagine the brand in the eyes, I imagine, of both the employees and then the future employees.
Definitely. And I had the privilege of being at this event in San Diego at ERE and watching the videos. And you could see for the first time, people were going over the parapet of their work to actually see what was going on and how they could create this meaningful experience for the candidates and then ultimately the employees. And they were very humble, which actually had the potential of damaging their brand, because they were too humble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being humble is good, but actually being aware of what everyone is doing and how good it is going to be a completely different thing. But what I really liked about Graham Johnson's presentation and his case study was just how he was able to evolve it, primarily because the CEO understood how the candidate experience and the employer brand impacted their bottom line, because they were losing customers if they had a really bad recruiting experience.
You write in this chapter, quote, words maketh the company. And we talk a lot on this podcast of the value and importance of words and how they can make all the difference in the world to someone.
Absolutely. People don't understand it just so much, how words can make a difference, and actually connecting to those words. So I went to my bank a couple of years ago, and I remember looking at their mission statement, and I won't mention which company,
okay.
But I went in there, and I looked at their mission statement, and I thought, oh, yeah, that seems a bit standard, and I don't actually see that mentality on the floor.
Mm.
And when you've got that kind of disconnect from the words and the people, that's when there's a brilliant opportunity to do a rebranding exercise and say, actually, what do we stand for? What are we about? How do we want to behave? How do we want to deliver the experience?
You talk about recruiters, and it kind of started with a bad experience you had, I think, when you were at Virgin, right?
Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
I started off with that because that was the very first seedling onto my entire journey over the past 27 years. And I just remember being shocked at the disconnect, again, on how a company at that time was trying to get me to be hired by Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, I just remember this headhunter who was representing the company just not connecting with me as a human. And I thought, there's something wrong with this process. But it took me my entire career in my 90s to evolve my understanding of public relations and brand management and marketing, and especially on an international level, to understand where all the disconnects were. And I purposefully made it my absolute goal, my drive. Even, you know, even in 1999, I remember having a conversation, this needs to change. How am I going to do it? And I initially went out and said, okay, I'm going to become a headhunter.
Mm-hmm.
And when I become a headhunter, I'm going to be able to connect the right people and with the right companies. That was just one little area. And again, it was realizing you've got all of these little areas and they need to all be connected together to create a very powerful ecosystem.
Which involves coaching, right? Yeah, that's a big part of your work.
Coaching is absolutely, it's the cornerstone. It's the foundation of it all. Because if people don't have that coach approach, which has to be learned, we all grew up with being told what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And we take a lot of that and the biases we have on delivering what we need to deliver to our workplace. And we have our own expectations. And what we don't learn, and I think Gen Z will probably be learning this a lot faster than, let's say, the baby boomers and even my generation. But we're in this situation whereby people need to learn the coach approach, which is listening, understanding, questioning, not to judge and to just jump in with an answer, but to really understand what is going on and what the potential solutions are, and then going into the action planning from that particular point. And too often, we're all just go either into solution mode, rescue mode, whatever mode we have built into our personalities. And once you understand what kind of personality you are, it might be a Myers-Briggs, for example. Rather than just pigeonholing you into that, you're then able to say, okay, what do I need to evolve? How do I need to adapt? How can I be a better person in this environment? And the emotional intelligence assessment is for that as well. Can give you an overview of how you operate in times of stress or when things are going well. And in either of those situations, you can be derailed. So, yeah, coaching is hugely important.
Yeah, it is not our reflexive mindset to do that level of coaching. I recall in the it was like maybe the early 2000s. We were having we were doing a show at Second City in a political year. I think there was an election, and the show was not political enough for us. And I had this aha moment when I was watching, and I'm like, oh, you know, this group of people who write and create their own show, I shouldn't be looking at what kind of show I want. What we should do is support them to make the best version of the show they want. And the minute that we kind of, the director and I talked about this and changed that mindset, they created an incredibly wonderful, rich show that got great reviews, mm-hmm. that had no politics, but no one cared because it was so authentic and good to who they were. And that was a really powerful moment for me of being like, I've been getting this wrong, and this is a better way of doing it.
Yeah, and it's well done to you for actually having that moment and having such great strength and being able to say, you know what, how I've been operating is wrong, and now I'm thinking in a different way, and it's going to be great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's. I mean, success is a trap, man. I mean, you know, when you do really well, and everyone around you is saying you do real well, and evidence sort of shows that. I find that's when you start to move into your least creative phases.
Exactly, and I noticed that the very, very first time I was working at Sony PlayStation. It was just before it was about to come out, and I remember saying at the time, Sega are playing complacently with their new Sega system that was about to come out. And I could see it in all of the body language. Everybody was too cocky and confident. And I knew I was going to do my absolute utmost to turn that over, which we did. We all did at the time. And PlayStation became a household name very quickly.
Yeah. I was reading your chapter on feedback, and this was very funny because I started to read the chapter and I wrote in the margins Kim Scott's name in Radical Candor. Yeah. Then I turn the page and you're quoting her. Kim's a great friend, and actually we have developed a thing called Improvising Radical Candor, which is a digital platform that also includes some live work, because what we realize is that people are terrible at feedback. She has a wonderful grid system for understanding how you can give honest feedback, but you have to do it by caring personally. And then we bring the improv element, which is now we're going to have you practice, and we're going to use these games to, you know, have you sort of play the role. And your whole thing's about this is like everyone's trying to avoid these difficult conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone is trying to avoid the difficult conversations. And I love the way that you and Kim Scott are working on games, because when you're able to play in those kind of environments that are really low risk.
Yeah, benign.
And learn how to actually give feedback and interpret when something is going in a particular way, you're able to diffuse it in a particular situation and call it by its name at that time. And once you have developed that muscle and you've played with it in that low risk environment, you're then absolutely able to go to that next level and then use it with your partner, with your kids,
yes,
with the store manager, with your employees and with your colleagues and with your clients. And it can be very, very, very powerful. So, yes, I'm a huge fan of Kim, and she was on my podcast as well some time ago. And I was just in love with her, absolutely in love with her movement.
And you add a nuance that it's not in her work, but you talk about the leaders. So we all know this, right? That in general, you want to give your negative feedback in private in those moments, and your praise publicly. But you talk about the power of leaders receiving negative feedback publicly, which I love and I firmly believe in. And the fact is, we have a phrase at Second City, take the fucking note. What we're getting at there is the director's going to give you the note, just take it. You actually don't have to use it. You don't have to believe it. You just are going to cog up the system. If you try to complain about the note and the time, you can just take it. Thank you for the note. And then, because all we're trying to do with these notes is guide you to a better place. And if you can get there on your own or a different way, no one's going to complain about that.
No, absolutely. And I remember years ago, people giving me certain notes about things. Years later, I go back to them and said, you know, what you said and what you told me, even though I didn't respond to you at that time, I have changed, and this is how I've changed, and it's thanks to you. So it's hugely important to be able to have that situation where you will accept it. It may hurt like hell.
Yeah.
Especially if you're very passionate about something. But you, to take that note, which I think that's a great statement, take the note.
Mm-hmm.
Take the note and then move on with it. Because once the brain has that information, it does some remarkable things.
Pretty soon, very soon, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. But before we get there, a few other little gems that I pulled out of here that I want you to talk about. At one point you say in the book, quote, you won't get any generation bashing from me.
No.
I believe this too. So what's your angle on that?
I've always been a millennial.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll do it.
I've always been a millennial. I was of when I was 16 or 17 or 18, everybody would be saying, oh, your generation. And I'd be saying, what do you mean? Your generation used to get exactly the same backlash. So just stop it. Learn from previous generations' mistakes and understand that there is this different understanding, different perspective, different. We're living in a different world. It's in history. And we're supposed to learn from history. So that's why I don't do generation bashing, because we all have different experiences, and it's up to us to learn and adapt and grow. And I remember I was in a group a couple of years ago on Facebook, a very reputable group, and there was somebody saying something quite negative about millennials, and I immediately jumped in and said, no. They're behaving just like I would have behaved at 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. I disagree. They are actually more advanced in all of these areas than we are. So, let's just calm down. And the great thing is that somebody at that time is a millennial, very young, under 20, under 30, I should say. And she's a doctor. Mm-hmm. And she said, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for speaking up for us. And it's like, well, you're the people that are going to be driving this world forward. You're the people that you have the most energy, the most power right now. And all this generation bashing, especially millennial bashing, has just been exhausting and painful to see. It's just going to make a generation not be empowered to make change.
Yeah, it's amazing that none of us have the memory of when the older generation was telling us to get off the lawn and how we felt about that. It's like, this is, you're just doing the same thing. Okay, one more I want you to talk about, which is, quote, the higher up the ladder someone climbs, the more unconscious incompetencies exist.
Yes, it's very similar to what you were saying, where once you've received success, you're then in this wonderful bubble of thinking, well, I can do no harm. I am absolutely fantastic. And, I wouldn't say that people will use those particular words, but they feel complacent. They are in their place of comfort. They are revered and acknowledged to be a leader in whatever particular situation. But guess what? If that person is looking for a job, or if they need to influence people in a particular way, they've got to go back to basics in networking and communicating what they are worth, what changes they've made, and how they're going to be able to lead others. So I'm a firm believer that in reality, the leaders need a coach just as much as anyone, if not more so, because they I'm pretty certain that we should coin a phrase called complacency disease or something like that.
Yeah.
Because, you get comfortable up there.
Yep. And if people want to Google the Dunning-Kruger effect, they can actually see the evidence behind this. And I guarantee you, you've all had a boss who you felt like you've seen this in action. Okay. So the way we end the podcast every week is we ask our guests for a yes and story. And so in the parlance of improvisation, you get nowhere by saying no. And you actually just can't say yes. That's not going to further anything. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute. And that sets you up. So you're able to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Yes, I do have a yes and story.
Great.
And it all started out when it was an absolutely crucial point that I had. It was a turning point for myself was when I decided that I was going to push outside of my comfort zone and I went to improv school. just for one Sunday, which was absolutely exhausting because everything was yes and, yes and, yes and. And we there were these accomplished actors all in a room, all doing their thing. And I was the new girl with no acting experience, trying to learn how to improvise in the moment and to play. You know, one minute I was a giraffe, the next minute I was a DJ, the next minute I had to do something else. And you have to think about your body language, you have to think about your what comes out of your mouth, you have to think about the other players in the room and to ensure that you're generously supporting them. And this was just in one session. It was profound, and that's when I realized the importance of teams. And not just the importance of teams, but also how I had to develop a yes and with my business, with my organization and what I was doing. And I well, it was around about the same time, winter, it was miserable. Vancouver winters are just miserable because we're right next to the mountains where it snows. And we're in the kind of valley area where it just rains solidly for 3 months, just like Seattle. And so I did this for some inspiration. Then I went to Mexico and had my big idea session on the beach with a notepad thinking, okay, I want an executive headhunting company, and yes, and it's going to be, we're going to coach them in the first 100 days once they've been placed, and we're going to coach leaders so they can evolve, and yes, and we're also going to support recruiters so they can develop, become emotionally intelligent recruiters. So, and I'm still in that yes, and phase. I've got a podcast, I've got a book. It just keeps going and going and going. But I've also got a yes and with regards to coaching as well. The yes and, when you feel that people are stuck in a situation and they finally come out with what they think is a conclusive answer, giving them the question, yes, and then just shutting up for a good 10 seconds. In your head, not saying anything, and counting to 10 very slowly until they speak, to allow them to come up with another idea on top of that.
Yeah, it's interesting that yes and can be silent. It can be some simply choosing not to get in our own way or try to fill up space and allowing the other to have their room to fill up that space.
Absolutely.
The book is called Elephants Before Unicorns. Caroline Stokes, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. And the world split in two from the throng of every living soul.
survive.